Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Tuesday, a week from today. All of America will be voting. Today, if you live in one of the states where there's early voting, get out and vote. Make sure that you're registered. And if they try to offer you provisional ballots, ask to see an elections judge. Or, you know, it varies from county to county, from state to state. I actually got an email from a poll worker saying, you know, please don't ask people to hassle us. Yeah, I understand. And it's tough work. And please understand that many of the people working in the polls, the vast majority of the people working at the polls, are doing this for basically squat. I mean, you know, volunteer pay for all practical purposes, virtually nothing. And they're people who are there because they care about the process. So, you know, be good, be nice, and realize they're not the ones who did the voter purges if you got purged. On the other hand, they may be able to help you. They may be able to help you find the person, depending on how it's handled in your state, who can get you back on the rolls or where you can appeal it. So, but the great Republican deregistration, disenfranchisement campaign continues to roll on. In fact, a phony flyer just went out to Virginians telling them that, well, here's exactly what it says. This official-looking flyer on the Commonwealth of Virginia letterhead, or what looks like it, says an emergency session of the General Assembly has adopted the following emergency regulations to ease the load on local electoral precincts and ensure a fair electoral process. If you are voting Republican, vote on November 4th. If you're voting Democratic, vote on November 5th. Right. So anyhow, we'll get into that. I want to get into the whole topic of American exceptionalism in our second hour today. In our third hour, Barry Steinhardt is dropping by from the ACLU Technology and Liberty Program about democracy-free zones, constitution-free zones in the United States. And Chris Hood is going to drop by. He's the whistleblower, the Diebold whistleblower, who is going to tell some startling tales. Right now, however, Yaron Brook is with us. Yaron is the president of the Ayn Rand Institute, ayn rand.org, the website, the holders of the flame of objectivism, the philosophy first put forward by Ayn Rand in fiction and Atlas Shrugged in The Fountainhead and later in a number of brochures and in the institution that she created. Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back. It's been a while since we've talked.
That's
right. Yaron, William Seidman was the chairman of the Resolution Trust Corporation that was put together by Jerry Ford, actually. By the senior Bush to deal with the explosion, the meltdown of SNLs when they were deregulated. And he's good friends with Alan Greenspan. And he had some thoughts on Greenspan and regulation and all that kind of thing. Let me just play. Well, I guess this is the main clip here. This is just 30 seconds. Let me play this for you, if I can get it into my
Alan heart. Greenspan, who is a great man and a great friend of mine from time to time, but yeah, you know, he spent 10 years with Ayn Rand. And he believed that people were economic machines. Not that they were never fraudulent, they never got mad, they were perfect economic machines. And unfortunately, it turns out that's not a very accurate description of how people behave, particularly when they can make a bundle of money in a hurry and get out before they get caught.
So, and then of course Alan Greenspan came out this weekend and talked about how he was shocked at all of this, and As I'm sure you've heard, I probably don't need to play it again, although I have it if you want it.
No, heard it enough.
Okay. You know, we have actually a truncated version of it here.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
I prefer that to the actual Greenspan quote. Is objectivism, I mean, Alan Greenspan was really the one guy who had considerable power over a 20-year period at the federal level in the United States. I've got several other quotes of Seidman talking about how Greenspan, when they came to him, in fact, this is one in particular, I think, that is actually germane. This is a relatively quick one, too.
It was proposed that their regulation...
He's talking about derivatives.
Yep.
...disclosure be required. And the industry fought it, and the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed. And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan in saying, look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day.
And then he goes on to talk about, you know, what happened with AIG.
Sure.
So are you ready to give up your membership in the Ayn Rand Institute?
Well, I mean, the problem is that it was Alan Greenspan who gave up his membership decades ago when, as head of Ronald Reagan's Social Security Commission, he suggested increasing payroll taxes and cutting benefits. And then by the very fact that he joined the Federal Reserve, an institution that just two decades earlier, he had written, shouldn't exist, distorts the market, creates bubbles, creates crashes. And indeed, that's exactly what he's done. I've called him years ago a serial bubbleist, because that's what his tenure at the Federal Reserve really amounted to, creating bubbles, creating crashes. Nothing, you know, none of his behavior resembles anything, that Ayn Rand, would advocate for. So he's never represented us, and you know, I can't take what he says with much seriousness.
Well, you know, he was a leading, loud, outspoken, and he cited Ayn Rand frequently.
Sure, in the 60s,
as his rationale spokesman.
60s and 70s. He hasn't, you know, since he became chairman of the Federal Reserve, he has not talked about Ayn Rand.
No, he has not.
He said purposefully he wasn't. And he tried to distance himself from Ayn Rand during his hearings when he was nominated for the Federal Reserve.
I think there was one exception in there. Whenever she died, he came to her funeral with a six-foot-tall dollar sign.
That was 1982, well before the Federal Reserve.
Ah, okay.
He was at a funeral in 82. You know, and he was friendly with her until she died. So I'm not distancing him from her in that sense. But every action he has taken since she died suggests that he never really understood her philosophy to begin with. And, you know, and this is not a new statement. You know, I'm on record criticizing Alan Greenspan for the last 10 years at least.
But, Iran, her thinking is
her thinking has been proved right by this crisis, because what she said all along and what Atlas Shrugged suggests is the mixed economy, what we have today of lots of government regulations and some economic freedoms, doesn't work. It leads to these crashes and to these bubbles. And we're seeing proof of that today. What she advocated is not a little bit of freedom here and a little bit of freedom there with lots of government involvement in between. What she advocated was a complete separation of economics from state, real laissez-faire capitalism, which we do not have. So you can't
blame laissez-faire
capitalism.
No, I understand that. But what's the point of a state if not to make sure that the economic system, which the state facilitates, I mean, an economic system is brought into existence by a state.
Yeah.
The markets are created by the state. The state issues the currency. The state defines the rules of the game.
Well, it shouldn't issue the currency. That's my point. It shouldn't issue the currency.
Well, our state doesn't issue our currency.
It didn't
issue,
which
is the disaster.
Up until 1913, banks issued currency, and the system worked very well. But the purpose of the state is to protect individual rights. That is, the purpose of the state is to step in when fraud is committed, is to step in when crimes are committed. The purpose of the state is...
That's Ayn Rand's perspective.
Yeah,
the founders of this country believed that the purpose of the state was to guarantee life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's right. And the way you guarantee life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and I think on this point I agree, you know, I'm close to founders, much closer to founders than you are, it was to protect individual rights, to protect your life, your freedoms, so the state buds out of what you do in your bedroom, and the state buds out of what happens in the boardroom. It does not intervene either in your personal activity or in your economic activities. All it does is protect exactly that, your right to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, and buds out everywhere else.
But the founders were, I mean, you know, they were passing legislation literally from the first Congress to provide for the poor. They were right from the very beginning taxing economic activity and regulating economic activity. How can you say that they were objectivists?
Well, I'm not claiming they were objectivists, unfortunately. I think the help to the poor came later. It came primarily in the early to mid 19th century. And to the extent that they passed that, they were wrong. I mean, they weren't perfect. They were geniuses. They were brilliant and much smarter than I am. But, you know, they were limited by the times in which they lived and they were not perfect.
Yeah.
They had slavery too, which is a huge tragedy. So they weren't perfect, but they got one thing right. The role of government is to protect the rights, the freedoms of individuals, and freedoms means leaving you alone, free of coercion.
Okay. Yaron Brook, ayanrand.org, the website. Yaron, thanks for dropping by.
Always a pleasure.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Out there that have figured out our monitoring capabilities and they're not happy about it, sir.
Well, it's too late for them to do anything about it. Take them a message, would you?
Yes, sir. What is it?
Every step you take.
Oh, they're going to be watching us.
Every rule you break. Every job you take and every dime you make, we'll be watching you.
Yes, Mr. McKenzie.
If you go astray,
Bush's Brave New World.
Most of you don't see. You belong to me. Your file chair gives us ownership. You don't have a say. We took your rights away. If you don't obey, we'll put you away.
Well, hopefully all of that's coming to an end over the course of the next week or so. I think it is. And as I said, I want to get into that at some length in the second hour. In this first hour here, our Twilight Zone alert. This is truly strange. This is from Jackson County, West Virginia, October 23rd, 2008. This is the testimony from the Video of the Vote folks. This is Virginia Metheny, a voter in Jackson County, West Virginia.
I voted on the first day of early voting. I went in that morning. It was about 10 o'clock. When I pressed to enter my vote for the Democrat, the check mark jumped to the one above to the Republican. Well, I pressed the Democrat again, and it jumped up again. So I asked a poll worker, I said, well, why will this machine not allow me to vote for my candidate? She said, it's got a sensitive screen. She said, you're touching it too hard. She said, just barely use the tip of your fingernail to touch it, which I did. Then I went to the next candidate. Well, it did the same thing. I voted for the Democrat. It jumped up to the Republican. Well, then she told me, she said, just keep pressing the one that you want to vote for, and it will finally take. Well, I did. And it did stay there. But
eventually, yeah. But she said, well, actually, I'll let her finish her sentence here.
I proceeded to have problems all through the ballot.
There you go. So, yesterday, I was talking to Ellen Ratner, and I said, by the way, Ellen, you need to tell the Republicans over at Fox News that in Decatur County, Texas, or Tennessee, rather, they're actually flipping votes from McCain to Obama, and so they can get hysterical about the voting machines, because all the reports that we've had for the last 8 years, actually going back to 98, all of the reports that we've had for the last 10 years have been that when people try to vote for Democrats on these electronic machines, it flips it to Republican. And there's never been a report of anybody going the other way. And here's a report. This is something that the Republicans should get hysterical about. They love getting hysterical about election fraud and voter, well, they call it voter fraud. Somebody should tell them about it. Well, I get an email here from Steve. He says he talked to Bernie Ellis, a Tennessee election integrity advocate, who checked this out and found and reported over Democratic Underground. In fact, it was not true. It did not flip from Republican to Democrat. So we're back to, you know, in all probability, it will not be covered by Fox. You won't find it on the Drudge. It will not be covered by the corporate media, because 100% of these cases so far are people touching touchscreens in the Democratic category, and it flips to Republican, never the other way around. On the front page of today's Financial Times, actually a whole series of stories in today's Financial Times, and in fact, the front page of the Wall Street Journal as well, the crisis deals new blow to Japan. Everybody's talking about Japan's stock market is crashing, the yen is going up in value. Why? And the Financial Times has an interesting op-ed, and this is the point here. Is that what has happened is that the international markets, including currency markets, have been so deregulated, so greenspanned, so libertarianized, so republicanized, that countries no longer control their own destiny, that governments elected by the people of those governments, democracies, no longer have control over their own economic destiny. It is now controlled by a small cabal of very, very wealthy and powerful corporations or individuals. And, for example, the Financial Times editorial today, saying the steamrollers finally arrived in February 2007. That was more than a year ago. The Financial Times warned that carry trades, now carry trades are borrowing in a currency offering low interest and investing in high interest currencies, right? So if the yen is, you can borrow in yen at 1%, and you can invest that money in U.S. Treasuries at 4%, then you do that, and then at the end of the year you pay the money back, and you made 3% on the spread. You don't do anything. You just make the profit. And you pay a maximum 15% income tax on that in the United States. Anyhow, they warned this might look attractive, but it's like having a free lunch in front of a steamroller. And they point out that the average daily turnover, this is the, you know, the number of trades in foreign exchange markets, is now over $3 trillion. Similarly, and because it's all been busted open. Similarly, they're talking about how Porsche just took over control of VW by using derivatives, completely outside of the market, unregulated derivatives, and it caused VW's stock price to spike up 147% in a day, so that Volkswagen stock right now is worth more than all the other U.S. and European car manufacturers put together. In other words, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. This is the speculation bubble. And why? Because the hedge funds were desperate to cover their short positions, and they had to go out and buy all these VW shares. So bottom line here, total deregulation of the markets means that a few people who know how to game the system get incredibly rich, and everybody else gets screwed, and entire governments might be brought down.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. Just want to mention one other, I think this is particularly noteworthy bit of news here. The headline from the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, U.S. mulls talks with Taliban in bid to quell Afghan unrest. Yep, General David Petraeus is suggesting that we should cut a deal with the Taliban just like we did with the Sunnis in Iraq. That is, we pay them not to shoot at us, and they behave nicely. This, by the way, is what George Bush did in 2001 when he gave the Taliban $40 million to cut down opium poppy production. And they did. They took his money and they did exactly what they said they'd do. And had Bush, after 9/11, taken the Taliban up on their offer to hand over Osama bin Laden for trial in a neutral third country, a whole hell of a lot of pain and death and destruction and 4.5 million Iraqi refugees and as many as 1 million Afghan refugees and an entire region destabilized would not have happened. But no, Bush didn't want to do it that way. But now Petraeus is at the same time that John McCain and Sarah Palin are out there going, oh, you don't talk to the enemy. Petraeus is saying, we need to talk to the Taliban. What's going on here? Well, I can tell you what's going on. Somebody knows what he's doing is running the military. Thankfully, it's not John McCain. And if you're thinking of taking a high-speed train across Europe, you know, the TGV, the French train, travels about 200 miles an hour. Don't carry your cell phone into the bathroom. 26-year-old man found himself in this embarrassing and painful position. Got his arm stuck in the toilet. The vacuum on the toilet was so strong he couldn't get his arm out. They had to physically remove the toilet and him on a stretcher from the train so they could get it on the concrete off the train where they could bust it up with a sledgehammer and free his arm. He was trying to get his cell phone that had dropped into the loo. Yeah. Be careful. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And David in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, howdy, Tom. Boy, I'll tell you, there's a lot more deaths that come from cell phones than that. That whole Darfur is all about mining the minerals. And
oh, you're right.
Yeah, the people right. that are carrying cell phones. Is today the day that they're doing the blackout of don't use your cell phone and find some other way to get around because
of the rare earth minerals. If it is, I'm unaware of it. But thanks for the heads up on that, David. I'll look around for it. I'll tell you the other thing. Having in March we did our show from 15-20 miles from the Darfur border in southern Sudan, and from a refugee camp there at Gok Machar. And the other big thing that's going on is oil. They're finding oil all across the northern part of southern Sudan and into western Sudan, which is Darfur. And everywhere they find oil, the north says, oh, this is now our territory. And Bashir moves his troops to the south. They burn villages, you know, kill the men, rape the women, send them off as refugees. And the Chinese are the ones who are exploring for the oil in most of southern Sudan now.
Hey, do you remember back in the 80s when Reagan was still in and William Casey was Bill Casey was the head of the CIA?
Yeah, after he was the head of Reagan's campaign, he was the guy who cut the deal with the Iranians to hold the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election.
Right. So what Casey did was he at the time, early satellite technology was able to be used in order to determine where minerals were. They were able to change filters on those satellites. The Landsat photographs were able to determine, you know, if you had a streak of iron ore or copper ore or, you know, molybdenum or some sort of thing, well, you could see it from these satellites. Well, it had been public information for a bunch of years and was commonly seen on things like Nova and many scientific TV programs and whatnot. All of a sudden, Bill Casey comes in and makes it all top secret, and then he keeps control of his own investments. And it was shown that Bill Casey was actually taking all of that Landsat information and selling it to private mining companies. And so you could determine where the wars of the future were based upon what the mineral needs were of various industries.
That's incredible. Well, his karma caught up with him. You know, the day that he was scheduled to testify before the Senate Committee on Iran-Contra, and he had told Milton Gould, who was his attorney, who has said this on the record, that he was going to testify fully, honestly, and openly to his involvement in keeping the hostages in Iran before the 1980 election. To cause Jimmy Carter to lose, because Carter, you know, 3 weeks out from that election, Carter was ahead by 7-8 points. and it was, you know, keeping the it was the failed hostage rescue that really doomed Carter's presidency. And Casey said he was going to testify fully and openly before Congress that morning. He was scheduled to testify that afternoon. 10 o'clock that morning, he's sitting in his office, director of the CIA, and he suddenly has a seizure, falls on the floor. They carry him off to the hospital. They take him to Bethesda. They open his brain, and they take out a piece of his left parietal lobe, which is called Broca's region, which is the part of the brain that processes speech. They literally cut out his tongue. They rendered him speechless.
Jesus.
He died about 8 weeks later from complications of the surgery.
Yeah, well, it was known that there were a bunch of strange deaths. Richard Helms of the CIA mysteriously fell off his rowboat and a lot of strange things. But yeah, you could tell where the wars of the future were going to be.
Yeah, that's fascinating. David, you called about something Yaron Brook said?
About which?
Did you call about Yaron Brook and the Constitution?
Well, what I was essentially, it was a challenge about Sarah Palin. You know, this Alaska, I've been calling Alaska radio stations just in the last couple of weeks, and I'd learned the other day, you remember the Exxon Valdez lawsuit, and the Supreme Court said, well, it's okay, they can finally only pay nickels on it instead of dimes. So it turns out that the Exxon Valdez lawsuit, they're still nickel and dime in it, and they're still not paying.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and it's an ongoing process.
Well,
David, I'm sorry, David, I got to move along here. I got a whole bunch of calls, and I appreciate the call. Ed in Detroit. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hello?
Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. That's interesting because I'm an Iranian-American, and I'm very familiar with the oil situation and all that, because since the British discovered oil in Iran, we had not have a 5 or 10 years of happy life and, you know, a stable situation.
This is what happens
country.
All over the world, Ed. Every country,
all over,
I mean, Nigeria,
all over the world.
Wherever you discover oil, the big corporations and the rich guys come in and the average person gets screwed. And then
that coup in 1953. Anyway, my comment was one of your callers said that the government should not intervene in the bedroom, the boardroom. Yeah. I agree with his first comment. But the boardroom, the best example, you just mentioned Japan, and also we had Rockefeller in the United States was gobbling up all the small businesses to build up his own empire. I mean, if the government is not intervening, then what are we going to end up with? I would like to just hear your comment.
Right. You're welcome, Ed. Thanks for the call. What you end up with is exactly what John Rockefeller had, which is it was called a trust, and that's why we had antitrust laws. Had it been called simply a corporation, we'd probably have anti-corporation laws, as our guest said yesterday. The bottom line is he wasn't just buying up the companies. He was driving them out of business. He was illegally colluding with the railroads to charge higher prices to transport oil from his competitors, the smaller businesses. And as a result, the Standard Oil Trust ended up owning all these companies. And Ohio said this is illegal and threw him out of the state. And that's when he went to New York, and that's when he said, okay, what state wants to change their laws? So what I'm doing is legal. And New Jersey and Connecticut and New York and Delaware and all these states up and down the East Coast did. Eventually, every state in the Union did. And now that kind of activity is no longer illegal, but it was up until the 1890s. Michael in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Well, I was listening to your recent caller. I'm always impressed that you have people with varying views on, but the objectivist guy.
You're on Brooke. Yeah.
Yes. I thought that anybody with any sense of history or knowledge of human nature had rejected objectivism a long time ago. But all right, then. When was it last week? Alan Greenspan got up there and said, you know, I guess there was a slight flaw in my philosophy that sort of came crashing to the ground. Even academic philosophy won't accept objectivism as a philosophy.
Well, here in fact, is Greenspan's quote.
We are in the midst.
Okay, let me turn it down.
Go ahead.
Here.
Yeah, right.
We are in the midst of a once in a century credit tsunami. Central banks and governments are being required to take unprecedented measures. As I wrote last March, those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself especially, are in a state of shocked disbelief. Such counterparty surveillance is a central pillar of our financial market state of balance. If it fails, as occurred this year, market stability is undermined.
Yeah, that counterparty surveillance, you know, in other words, the sophisticated people working with sophisticated, you know, that's the essence of objectivism. And,
and
you know, it has never worked anywhere in the world.
Anywhere in the world, anywhere in history. And how can I guess denial is a very strong thing, but I have as hard a time with that man's...
Well, Yaron is an idealist, and I can't, you know, I don't want to try and speak for him. I have a lot of respect for Yaron, but I think that many idealists, whether they're objectivists or libertarians or Trotskyites or Bolsheviks or Marxists, just think, if only everybody would behave this way, then everything would be great.
But they don't.
Yeah, and right, Michael, and just everybody doesn't behave that way. As William Stevens said, you know, he said, Greenspan thought that people were perfect economic machines. Turns out they're not. They get greedy. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Get out there and vote, my friends. They're going to steal 7, 8, 9, 10 million votes this year. We've got to turn out 15, 20, 25, 30 million. Extra. And no, I don't mean vote early, vote often. I mean just get out there and vote. There are enough. America is a fundamentally big D democratic, or at least a progressive country. It really and truly is. The vast majority of Americans want the kind of country we always had. Not always. Before Reagan, let's say. Yeah, Sarah Palin.
So it doesn't sound like a whole lot of folks here on November 4th will be supporting Barack the Wealth Spreader.
No.
What that means is government taking more of your money and doling it out however a politician would seem fit.
Right.
Now, that spreading the wealth around really is just a scheme for income distribution.
Yeah.
Joe didn't buy it. He said that he sure thought that sounded like socialism.
Uh-oh.
Nevada, that is because you understand that his plan to redistribute wealth will ultimately punish hard work. It discourages productivity. It will stifle the entrepreneurial spirit that made this the greatest country on earth.
Mm.
The politician who wants to raise taxes and redistribute your hard-earned money according to his priorities.
What doesn't work is any hint of socialism, again, at a time like this.
His plan to redistribute wealth will ultimately punish hard work, and it discourages productivity, and it will stifle the entrepreneurial spirit that made this country the greatest country on earth.
Yeah, and at the same time, Sarah, let's talk about the fact that your state is sharing the wealth. Let's see. Alaska, the no sales tax, no income tax. If you live there, you get a $3,200 check every year from the Alaskan government. The wealth being shared. In fact, it's the only state in the country where the wealth is shared, where the wealth is passed out to everybody. The wealth from the mineral resources. Yuck. Sarah Palin, the Marxist, makes charges against Barack Obama. Somehow, I think not. 866-303-2270, Dan in Gaylord, Michigan. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Love the show.
Thanks.
You know, what really gets me about some of these supply-side economists and the objectivists is they completely ignore the concept of aggregate demand. And, you know, they always just assume that there's unlimited demand for whatever product that they're going to market and produce. And the fact is it's just not true. You know, for example, like Henry Ford realized this when he ran out of customers to sell his motor cars to. So what he did was gave all his workers a raise, and now they could afford to buy the cars that he was producing, guaranteeing himself a market, and that their extra wages actually went out into the economy and lifted everyone up because they had more money to spend on more, they had more discretionary income. So,
although truth be told, it was Henry Ford's business partner who went on to become a progressive senator in Michigan and his wife who pushed for that rather than Henry Ford himself. But you're right. And classically, economists have always known, and just common sense tells you, demand drives everything. And the engine for demand is wages. And so if you want to boost, and this is, and thank you, Dan, for pointing this out. This is why, I mean, already you've got people talking about we need another economic stimulus. Let's toss another $200 or $300 billion into the pot and mail everybody in the United States another $400 or $500 check. Here's what's wrong with that. Yes, it will stimulate the economy over the short term. But it does nothing structural. It does nothing over the long term. Over the long term, the way that you build an economy is by driving up wages. You increase wages. There are a couple of ways to do that. One is to limit the supply of workers, which is basically what unions do, closed union shops do. You say, you know, these are the workers you've got to negotiate with them. Number one, limit the supply of labor. This is why you saw a middle class emerge after the Black Death in Europe and after the after every major war, you see a lot of people die off, and all of a sudden middle classes pop up. Why? Because there's fewer workers. There's more demand for labor. The price of labor goes up. Well, that's not a real efficient way to do it. I'm not suggesting that there should be, you know, any kind of mass deaths or anything. Number one way to do it is control the supply of labor through unionization. And number two is by setting a floor on the price of labor with minimum wage laws. And you see this working all across Europe. We saw it worked in the United States for a long time. And now the minimum wage is so low compared to the cost of living that it's no longer working. So we just need to fix that. Wages drive demand, and demand drives an economy. And then supply comes along to answer demand. It's just that simple. It's really just that simple. Greg in Cucamonga, Florida, or California, rather. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Oh, hello. I heard you talking about Alan Greenspan's remarks about he's shocked about human greed and then talking to the Ayn Rand people. There's some comments I wish you would be able to talk with them about the founding fathers actually tried the free market situation in the 11 years before the Constitutional Convention. I guess Thomas Paine was a big advocate of faith in the people, and the economy tanked. You know, there was just chaos. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading, you know, there's an article in the L.A. Times written by a man, Michael Oreskes, who wrote The Genius of America, How the Constitution Saved Our Country,
right,
and Why It Can Again. So actually this Milton Friedman-type free market thing was actually tried in the 11 years before.
Yeah. And then in 1791, Alexander Hamilton brought forward his paper on manufacturers, his address on manufacturers or whatever it was called, something like that, something on manufacturers, submitted it to Congress and said, you know, we need to protect our manufacturing industries. We need to put into place import tariffs. We need to encourage exports. We need to encourage domestic industries. He just laid out basically what became modern America. I think in large part to his credit, he saw America as an industrial country. Jefferson opposed that, by the way. Jefferson thought we should be an agricultural country. There were some substantial disagreements between those two men. And I have to say, you know, looking back on it, that I think that Hamilton was right and Jefferson was wrong on that, which is not something you hear me say very often. But, Greg, thanks a lot for pointing that out. You're absolutely right. Spot on. Coming up in the next hour, what does it mean to be an American? And how is that different from what it means to be a citizen of pretty much any other country in the world? What is American exceptionalism? And should we embrace it, or is it a danger? Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. How do liberals and progressives control America? Is control the right word? What is America based on? What does it mean that we're going to have a change in government? I mean, everybody, we talk about change. What does this change mean? What are the consequences of it? How does this all work? What are all the moving pieces? What is it to be an American? What does it mean to be an American? How is America different than every other nation? Here's a story. This Greg Sargent writing I'm not sure where this was originally published. Received it in email from a bunch of different people. This may be an AP story. Some three dozen workers at a telemarketing call center in Indiana walked off the job rather than read an incendiary McCain campaign script attacking Barack Obama, according to two workers at the center and one of their parents. Now, in Indiana, there is a state law that makes it illegal to do robocalls. So in order to slime Barack Obama, they had to actually hire a telemarketing firm that had, you know, one of these big buildings with 100 people in it, and they're all sitting in a cubicle, and they're calling up saying, hey, you want to buy some light bulbs or nylon stockings or whatever? Today they were calling and saying, do you want to know about Barack Obama? So they had to actually hire people. Nina Williams, a stay-at-home mom in Lake County, Indiana, tells us that her daughter recently called her from her job at the center, upset that she had been asked to read a script attacking Obama for being, quote, dangerously weak on crime, quote, coddling criminals, and, quote, for voting against protecting children from danger, end quote. Williams' daughter told her that up to 40 of her coworkers had refused to read the script and had left the call center after supervisors told them they would have to either read the call or leave. Call center is a company called AmeriCall. It's located in Hobart, Indiana. They walked out, Williams said of her daughter and their coworkers, adding that they weren't fired but willingly sacrificed pay rather than read their lines. Which, by the way, I would say is a testimony to the company. I mean, the company just took a job, and when the workers refused to read the scripts, they didn't fire them. So let's not get all over the company about this. We were asked to read something saying Obama and Democrats were against protecting children from danger, another worker said. I wouldn't do it. A lot of people left. They thought it was disgusting. So what we're seeing here is apparently some of these folks have this notion of America, a belief in America, that is different or inconsistent with the idea of simply sliming a candidate, win at all costs. This is how the notion has changed. Here's the key to all of this. Every other country in the world, and maybe there are exceptions to this, I can't think of any. If you can think of any, you know, give me a call and let me know. But every other country in the world, by and large, arguably, I suppose you could say some of the nations that Central and South America in particular, where there's a lot of Spanish ancestry folks in addition to indigenous folks. But pretty much every other country in the world, you are a citizen of that country because you have a genetic heritage. If you're Italian, it's because you're Italian. And you speak Italian and you look Italian and you can go back. If you're French, it's because you're French. It's about the DNA. You're Norwegian, it's because you're Norwegian. You're Nigerian, it's because Somalian. Actually, Somalia is pretty much everybody in the country. I just heard this oddly enough this morning on I forget what station it was. They were talking about Somalia, and they kind of noted parenthetically that it's pretty much all one tribe. This nation, which is, you know, many of the national boundaries in Africa were carved out by the colonizing powers, and they didn't respect tribal boundaries. Apparently, Somalia largely did. But the point is that in most countries, there is a culture based on a shared assumption of we are all part of this tribe. And in the United States, it's a little different. In the United States, it is the only country that was founded on the basis of an idea rather than the basis of genetics. Now, granted, many of the founders were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males, but that was, and in fact, there was a meme running through the early founding that, you know, African Americans weren't included, women weren't included, things like that. But that wasn't central to the founding of the country, and that's why it was inevitable that we would rise above those early limitations. There was an interesting story, I think it was in the International Herald Tribune 3 or 4 days ago, about a fellow in France who was being interviewed, and he said, oh, there's no way that the Americans will vote for Barack Obama. You know, he represents a minority that's only, what, 11, 12, 14% of America's people, African-Americans. And, you know, he doesn't represent the majority. The white guy will win. I mean, this is what this this French guy was saying. And the countries that are based on genetics are struggling right now. In France, with the influx of Algerians from their colonization of that country, so they have Africans living in France, and they're saying, and the French are saying, hey, you know, you've got to become French. Or, frankly, what is more often being said is, you can never become French, because you're not genetically French. The Germans are dealing with the same problem with the Gastarbeiters, the Turks that they brought in after World War II to work in Germany. Big debate about whether they should have German citizenship and to what extent and when and how. So because America is uniquely among most nations created based on a story, this story of democracy, the story of human rights, this story of blocking the concentration of wealth, the story about the necessities that home, food, health care, back in the founding of this country, land was essentially free, home was available to everybody, health care was widely available, the government paid for the poor. Happiness of the people is an important function of government. It's written into our Constitution, into the Declaration of Independence. These are radical notions at the founding of this country. We are based on an idea. Now, the goodness of that is that it was essentially a noble idea. It was this idea that came out of the early 1600s, out of the Enlightenment, that started with Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, who was both the original conservative and the original liberal, came up with the original conservative idea that people are essentially evil, came up with the original liberal idea that people could govern themselves. Or actually, it was Locke who followed Hobbes, who said people could govern themselves. Hobbes' original liberal idea was that people should be able to own their own property. And then Locke came along and amplified that life, liberty, and estate, life, liberty, and private property. So the wonder of it is that we were founded on this really noble idea. The danger is that because we're a country that is based on an idea, whoever controls the idea at the moment controls the country. And that realization is what led Joseph Kurz and a small band of very, very wealthy right-wingers in the 1960s and 1970s to say, collectively, we're going to change America's idea of itself. We're going to grab control of the controlling story in this country, because America is not a nation based on DNA. People are not Americans because they happen to come from England or from Europe or from Africa or from Asia or from South. People are Americans because they subscribe to the idea of America. And the proof of this writ huge is the Obama candidacy. But we've seen it over and over and over again in our history, as we've transformed ourselves by changing our story, not by changing our genetics. So the danger is whoever controls the story controls the country, and the opportunity is that whoever controls the story controls the country. So what Joe Kors and his merry band did was they said, okay, we're going to control the story. And they put together the Heritage Foundation and a series of other right-wing think tanks so that they could comment on every news story, so that they could change the meme, so that they could change the language, so that they could change the inheritance tax to the death tax, so they could change the idea of taxation as the price of liberty, as the price of civilization, into a burden. So they could change the idea that we're all in this together into it's us, it's the individual against everybody else. And they actually succeeded. With the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, they changed the story of America. And for the last 28 years, the story of America, even Bill Clinton bought into it. See, it was Bill Clinton who said the era of big government is over. It was, you know, so right across the board, they changed the story of America from one of government is us and we're all in this together to government is a them, it is evil, and we're not all in this together. Each one of us is on his own, and the rich are rich because they are more noble and they work harder and they're more brilliant, and the poor are poor because they're lazy. That was the meme that they laid out. And now Obama has an opportunity to turn that story back. How should he do it? How should we do it? Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, here's the danger and the opportunity. I don't think most Americans realize how far down a road of change we actually are. This is something that I have only, frankly, personally been realizing this over the course of the last 3 or 4 weeks. It took me that long to figure this out. And you know, not like I'm some, you know, all-knowing observer or something. I mean, I have a feeling, though, that most of us have not yet figured this out. And that is that Barack Obama, by running a campaign that is entirely taking the higher road, that is not engaging in slime and slash and burn tactics against his opponent. They're not talking about how John McCain dumped his first wife and was unfaithful to her when she waited for him all those years. They're not talking about his Vietnamese captors who said that he was never tortured and that he made propaganda tapes for him. They're not talking about the possibility that in the 1960s, when he was young and wild and crazy, he was in a car crash that killed somebody. They're not talking any of this stuff. I mean, there is stuff that could be used against McCain that they're not going anywhere near. Instead, they're talking about a positive vision of America. And many of us early on said, that's not going to win. And boy, were we wrong. So Barack Obama is laying out this story, and he has fundamentally changed, I believe, how campaigning is done in America. And the question is, will he change how governing is done? Keep in mind, the last time this story changed was during Franklin Roosevelt's administration. Well, there was the Reagan change. It flipped to the right. But the last time it flipped to the left, as it were, to the We Society, into the Jeffersonian model, into the model of the original founders. We go back and forth like this in the United States. We started out with this model of we're all in this together. In 1790s, you know, 1787, 1789, the ratification of the Constitution. And then in the 1830s, it kind of flipped to, no, we're all right-wingers here, slaveholders. And then in the 1860s, after the Civil War, it flipped back to, no, we're all in this together. And then in the 1880s, when the rise of the railroads, it flipped back to, no, we're all right-wingers here. And then with Teddy Roosevelt, 1901, it flipped back, no, we're all in this together. And then in 1910, it flipped back into the right-wingers and essentially went down, you know, that led right to the Republican Great Depression in 1929, and then it flipped back to, yes, we're all in this together, and that was Roosevelt. If Obama's going to create this kind of change, he has to have more than a legislative agenda. He has to have a story, and he has to realize the kind of opposition he's going to come up against. When Franklin Roosevelt tried to change the story of America, he was attacked for being a communist, for being a socialist, explicitly. My father went to his grave hating Franklin Roosevelt. My father was a good man and a good Republican all his life, and he thought that Roosevelt took us down a socialist road. I mean, that was the meme of the day. And that's the meme that they're going to play against Barack Obama. And in fact, this even led to an attempted overthrow. This is General Smedley Butler. Some clips from the History Channel. General Smedley Butler talking about how he was enlisted by Prescott Bush and the DuPonts and the Morgans and the very, very wealthy of the day to literally overthrow Franklin Roosevelt.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The plan, as outlined to me, was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club, at least, to intimidate the government.
Now, keep in mind, Smedley Butler, a Marine Corps general, was the most decorated veteran in American history at this point. Everybody in America knew him. He was a national hero.
And break down our democratic institutions. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government. I felt it was my duty to tell all I knew of such activities to this committee. My main interest in all this is to preserve our democratic institution. I want to retain the right to vote, the right to speak freely, and the right to write. If we maintain these basic principles, our democracy is safe.
So this was General Smedley Butler talking about how he had been hired to raise an army of 500,000 men to launch a coup to actually overthrow Franklin Roosevelt. That's how powerful changing a story is. Franklin Roosevelt came along and said, we're going to change the story of America. We're going to change it back to the story that the founders had in mind, that we're all in this together, that we are a community of individuals, that we are a peaceful nation, that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, that we're going to move forward, we're going to have progress. And that so intimidated the right-wingers that they launched a coup attempt against him. But he pushed through. That was the power of the story. And he transformed America for a generation. I mean, literally transformed America. And that's the opportunity before Barack Obama right now, this extraordinary opportunity to transform America. Is he going to be able to do it? I think so. Is he actually going to do it? I hope so. What will make it happen? Us. Franklin Roosevelt was pushed by the people, by the base. And if we don't push this, if we don't push Barack Obama, if he is elected, God willing, as President of the United States, if we don't push him, we will have lost an extraordinary opportunity.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Back to mainstream media, one listener at a time, one station at a time, one day part at a time, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Oh, Sarah Palin, ain't she something? Sarah O-12, they're shouting now when she goes to give speeches. O-12? They're selling I Heart Palin bumper stickers on cars, Team Sarah t-shirts. There's a website, Team Sarah, Sarah Pins, You Go Girl, You're in Palin Country, Maverick Barracuda. Yeah. So, meanwhile, John McCain's advisors, one of them recently called her a diva. Now, another has gone on the record, well, off the record, but on the record, anonymously, upping the ante in the conversation with the Politico's playbook, labeling Palin a whack job. Our conservative alert for the day. Anyhow, just to wrap up this whole idea, this whole concept. Bottom line, if Obama can change the story of America, he will be a transformational president. And here's what causes me to believe that that's what's on his mind. He was asked to name the most recent transformational presidents, or the transformational presidents of the 20th century. And he said Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan. He did not include Bill Clinton. Now, Bill Clinton took that as a personal insult. He thought that Barack Obama was putting him down. Not true. Bill Clinton was not a transformational president. He didn't change the story of America. He went along with the right-wing story, by and large. He declared the era of big government over. He said, we're going to end welfare as we know it. Blah, blah, blah. He basically continued the right-wing war on the New Deal. So the transformational presidents of the 20th century really were the first Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, arguably Woodrow Wilson with his efforts to bring us into the League of Nations in World War I, although he was unsuccessful getting us into the League of Nations. Certainly Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, flipping us, you know, left, right, you know, arguably like that. And if Obama understands this, and apparently he does, I mean, that was his answer to the question, then he can truly transform America and by changing our stories. And if he's successful in changing our stories, then that change will be deep and grounded, just like Reagan's change was. He'll change us for generations in a way that will make this country a better, more positive, healthier, happier place to live, and a better citizen among the world, and actually might even bring about peace in the world. I realize this is the, like, really kind of, sounds almost New Age, far out stuff, but I think this is a real possibility. And I'm telling you, 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was thinking this is just another candidacy. Ty in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Ty, thanks for listening to WNYY. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to say that to respond to him, I think the good news is that America is constantly a nation of revolutions. It was founded on revolution, and the number 13, you know, our colonies, and the you know, the numbers on the triangle and the dollar bill. So our mythology, the story that's been stolen, is actually still hidden in the dollar bill and our common myth. But unfortunately, he's right. The conservative narrative is one of, like, never leave the homeland, be tommed away, like, be prideful that you don't travel. It's been an anti-intellectual thing, which is why so many of the right-wing shows are just, they're completely insulting the intelligence. The narrative is not educated at all. It's not, you know, it's not surging. It's status quo, so to speak.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Ty. We are a revolutionary country, and thank you for that. And in fact, Thomas Jefferson suggested every 19 years we should revisit the Constitution. You know, in other words, every generation, he said we should, you know, let the dead past bury. Well, that was Longfellow who said, let the dead past bury its dead, but from his Psalm of Life. But you know, essentially that sentiment that a generation should be looking to the present and forward rather than to the past. And, you know, I thought it was a good one. It was a really good one. Mark in Connecticut. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for your awesome contribution to the conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. What do you think will look like if Obama is radicalized by the population? Like, what will that look like? Will there be revolutions in the streets? Is it going to be a quiet thing over the internet? And then I have a kind of a follow-up question. It's more philosophical in nature. Like, you know, you really laid out nicely the cyclical nature of government in this country. Do you think that's over? Like, is it, and I guess you already answered this about 5 minutes ago, that you think it's possible that it is, that Obama could break the cycle, that this cyclical nature of going back and forth between, like, kind of neo-fascism and democracy could be broken. Do you really believe that that's possible?
No. I think that cycle is always going to exist in the United States, because those are the two dynamic tensions at the founding of this country. We're always going to bounce back between those two poles, frankly, and probably every other generation is where the bounce is going to occur. And I, you know, Strauss and Howe's The Fourth Turning was a real enlightening book to me in that regard. You know, every four generations you have a Great Depression and a war, and it forms the basis for the next three generations. I think there is something to that. On the other hand, every time we experience a transformation, it not only transforms us, it transforms the world, and we never go back farther than we were before. In other words, think about Lincoln, for example. He was the first transformational president of the 19th century. And Lincoln, at the time of the Civil War, there were only two or three other democracies in the world. I mean, there was just a small handful. And within 30 years after the Civil War, there was a very large handful. A number of countries had become democratic, small d democratic. And the reason why was because most of the world thought that we were this weird experiment. And, you know, they were just fine with kings and kingdoms and like that. And when the Civil War happened, they were all sitting around going, okay, this is it. The experiment's over. They're going to fail. You know, de Tocqueville wrote that nice book, Democracy in America, in 1836, and we were all fascinated by it. But here it is 20 years later, and we're watching it melt down. And, in fact, we didn't melt down. And we came together after the Civil War, and we healed the wounds. And that, you know, that was the first stepping forward, right? And then freeing of the slaves, and then in the 1920s, empowering women, and then in the 1960s, really and truly talking about civil rights in an honest and straightforward way. And every time one of these progressive revolutions has happened, and Teddy Roosevelt, for that matter, busting up the trusts, every time one of these progressive revolutions has happened, even though we've gone backwards a little bit in the next conservative revolution, we never went backwards as far as we went forward. We've been continuously moving forward. So I think that Obama will move us forward. And the way that he would do that, Mark, is with his communication skills. And this is what I would love to see. And Mark, thank you very much for the call. Here, this is FDR from his fireside chat in May of 1940. Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What he did was every month he'd sit down with Americans by the radio and he'd say, listen, I just want to tell you what's going on in the world.
It is whispered by some that only by abandoning our freedom, our ideals, our way of life, can we build our defenses adequately, can we match the strength of the aggressors. I did not share those illusions. I do not share these fears. Today, we are more realistic, but not let us not be calamity howlers and discount our strength. Let us have done with both fears and illusions.
He was talking, he's arming for World War II, right? And he's saying, don't worry, we're bigger than that. And he's saying we don't have to give up our liberties in order to move forward. The exact opposite of what George Bush said.
While our navy and our airplanes and our guns and our ships may be our first lines of defense, it is still clear that way down at the bottom, underlying them all, giving them their strength, sustenance, and power...
Here comes the story.
...are the spirit and the morale of a free people.
See, that's the story.
For that reason, we must make sure in all that we do... that there be no breakdown or cancellation of any of the great social gains which we have made in these past years. We have carried on an offensive on a broad front against social and economic inequalities, against abuses which had made our society weak. That offensive should not now be broken down by the pincers movement of those who would use the present needs of physical military defense to destroy it.
See, this is exactly, he's just saying, don't do what George Bush did. This is what Obama needs to say.
There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a lowering of the standards of employment. Minimum wages should not be reduced.
So here's FDR saying, yes, we're looking at war with the Germans and the Japanese, the possibility of this. We're looking at an economic disaster in the United States, the result of 30 years of Republican rule. But this is not an appropriate time. This is not a good reason to give up the ideals of this country, the standards on which this country was founded, the dream of this, the story of this country. It's all about the story. And as the story changes, the country changes. Franklin Roosevelt changed our story by sitting down with us every month or regularly as fireside chats, sitting down and telling us stories about who we were. Ronald Reagan changed our stories by giving us speeches about who we were. They were, in my opinion, wrong stories, but they were stories that we adopted. Barack Obama now has the opportunity to transform America's stories again.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
That's me and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew and that I lied to you. But I'm not the only one hiding smoking guns. We blow smoke in your eyes.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was so brilliant about this, and he just laid it right out, that it's all about the story. And I'm just so captivated by this idea. This is such a powerful... again, we're listening to his May 1940 May of 1940, his fireside chat, and he's talking about the war, right? And the present emergency.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
Can you imagine if George Bush had said something about that? But his story is that it's an opportunity, you know? Roosevelt continued.
Today's threat to our national security is not a matter of military weapons alone. We know of other methods, new methods of attack.
Yeah, and then Roosevelt gets into this whole thing about sowing discord, about how people sow discord among the American people in order to divide us from one another. And that's exactly the Republican strategy today. It is history repeating itself on steroids. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, you're at the United Nations today.
Every time I get really sort of depressed about the financial situation of America, I come to the United Nations, and that helps me keep perspective. I mean, they are trying to take over Goma in the Congo right now. They took over the village where the mountain gorillas live. It's really not a very good situation.
Who's the they?
The group CNDP, which is the National Congress for Defense of the People, which is sort of a renegade.
A basic bandit
they're
group.
They're not exactly the good guys.
Yeah.
The rebels, we would say. Anyway, so the United Nations is just trying to make sure people are safe and feeding them, and it's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
A big mess. A couple other things going on, and that is that housing prices. Remember, I said yesterday that new homes had been selling, but the price had dropped. Well, overall housing prices have dropped 17.7% in the last 12 months. Consumer confidence is now measured. It has dropped 20 points to 38.0, down from 61.4 in September. Wow. Economists expected it only to go to 52. Today, also, Tom Boehner said he has his own economic plan that he is going to release. He wants to double the child tax credit from $1,000 to $2,000. He wants to reduce corporate taxes from 35% to 25%. Now, listen to this one. He wants to suspend all capital gains taxes, I believe, for the next 2 years. All capital gains.
Oh, the Walton family will do very well, won't they?
Is that unbelievable?
All the billionaires in America have to be cheering. What John Boehner is suggesting basically is taking us back to the Gilded Age, to the age of the robber barons. And, you know, we've been there, we've done that, we've seen what happens. I mean, this is what happened in the 1890s, this is what happened in the 1920s, and it's what happened in the 1980s, and every single time that we basically said, okay, we're going to give everything to the rich and hope something trickles down, it turns us into a nation of peons.
Certainly, as a nation he's never going to get it passed. So I don't think we have to worry, even if McCain became president. It's not going to happen. But that is what his plan is. He also said that he wants to allow all businesses to expense property, acquired property, as a business expense. Just small businesses. Also, Mike McConnell from the National Intelligence, as you know, he's the National Intelligence Czar. Apparently, they spent $4 billion more on intelligence this last year. The whopping, just on intelligence, $47.5 billion.
Wow. I hope we got something for the money.
Well, I hope so, too. But since it's all done in secret, your guess is as good as mine. Also, National Child Left Behind, there are new regulations on that. One of them is actually pretty good. They want colleges to track dropouts and graduates, essentially from kindergarten, because what was happening is high schools weren't doing that, and so there was no real understanding of how many kids started out in kindergarten and how many actually wound up in college. They don't want the schools to set their standards, individual targets and standards. That's a little more difficult because the school can set a standard that would never meet sort of a national level.
Right. On the other hand, is this kind of in the context of No Child Left Behind, or is this just trying to figure out where we're at, or what?
No, this is the context of sort of new regulations for No Child Left Behind.
Interesting. These the national standards, frankly, I find a little creepy, because you end up teaching to the test. We had a great tradition in the United States of communities providing good education. The biggest problem is just the inequality in incomes in different communities to fund the education. I think that that's where we need to be, you know, at the national level looking at is funding rather than regulating. Let the local communities do the regulating. In my
opinion. I have to say I'm very mixed about that because I've seen what happens in places like Mississippi where communities can set low standards. They can also set very high standards.
Yeah, but see, if they don't have the money, then the standards become kind of irrelevant.
Money is everything on this. I agree.
Yeah, it really is. And that's the role of the federal government is to equalize so that the education you get is not an accident of where you got born. But in any case, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service at the United Nations, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Coming up next, Barry Steinhardt with the ACLU.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it possible? Is it possible that parts of America have become constitution-free zones? Is it possible that most of America has become a constitution-free zone? Barry Steinhardt has served as the Associate Director of the American Civil Liberties Union from 1992 to 2002. He's been the Director of the ACLU's Program on Technology and Liberty since 2002. The Director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program, Barry Steinhardt, ACLU.org, the website. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Tom.
I don't think that most Americans have any idea that the federal government is asserting that if you live within 100 miles of a border, which presumably includes the oceans on both sides of our country, which and constitutes about two-thirds of our population, if I'm reading this right, if you live within 100 miles of a border, then you live in an area where the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which protects us against unreasonable search and seizure, no longer counts. Do I have that right?
Unfortunately, you do. That's exactly right. Federal government did, what the Bush administration did, was the Congress said that they would have these extraordinary powers to enforce our immigration laws within a, quote, reasonable distance from the border. Now, most people would think of a reasonable distance meaning sort of in the immediate vicinity of the actual border. But the Bush administration interpreted that to mean within 100 miles of a border. That's either a maritime border or a land border. That's, as you said, about just shy of two-thirds of Americans, as well seem to like particularly, I think, water. About two-thirds of us live within 100 miles of the border.
So all of New York City, all of Los Angeles, all of San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, I think we're about 80 miles inland, so the city where I live,
yep.
Miami.
Every major metropolitan area in the United States, of the top 10, only one, Dallas-Fort Worth, is outside the 100-mile zone.
Wow. And what they are asserting, what the Bush administration is asserting and actually doing, actually they're actually engaging in behavior based on this assertion, is that they have the right in these democracy-free zones, in these constitution-free zones, to simply at will, willy-nilly, violate the Constitution.
Well, they say, of course, they're not violating the Constitution. They're adhering to the Constitution by conducting these searches pursuant to their authority to patrol the borders. The problem is that they've extended the border so far out that these extraordinary search and seizure powers that they assert now theoretically apply to two-thirds of Americans. And don't be mistaken about this. They're beginning to do that. We had a fellow at our press conference earlier this week, for example, who was subjected to a search 15 miles from the Pacific Ocean on the grounds that that was within the 100-mile zone of the border. This is out in California, and it was an extraordinary sort of search of his car, something they could not have done, for example, in the interior of the United States.
Yeah, the Fourth Amendment is pretty unambiguous about this. I mean, it's just, I'll read it. It's one sentence. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So you need a warrant, and you need somebody to swear under oath that there's a probable cause that you're probably committing a crime in order to get the warrant. And, I mean, it's right there, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And the Bush administration is asserting that if you live within 100 miles of the ocean or 100 miles of the Mexican or Canadian border, that Fourth Amendment no longer applies.
But that's exactly right. I would only amend it to say it also asserts within 100 miles of the Great Lakes, which is a wide swath of middle America.
So that includes Chicago and includes Detroit.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, you know, and they're beginning to assert these powers. And in our view, we need to draw a line.
It's Milwaukee. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's like,
well, it does go on and on. We need to say, no, that's not right. First of all, it's not what the Congress intended. The Congress did not intend that reasonable distance from the border was 100 miles.
Right.
But secondly, that whatever authority you have at the border, also needs to be limited by the Constitution, but it applies to the border. It doesn't apply to the interior of the United States,
right,
where most Americans live.
We're talking with Barry Steinhardt. He's the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. ACLU.org is the website. Barry, as the guy who's in charge of the Technology and Liberty Program, I'm wondering to what extent have we lost our rights with regard to technology as well? Beyond this particular issue, I think you've described this well. And my other question for you with regard to this is what can we do about this? But also, what's going on with things like, you know, searching our email, tracking our web activity, spying on people by use of telephones, et cetera? I mean, where are we at in this country?
We're not at somewhere that's very good. The reality is that this administration in particular, the outgoing administration, has parlayed all the advantages that technology gives them to engage in mass surveillance into mass surveillance. So, for example, they do mass surveillance of telecommunications, not only voice communications, but email. And they do it through the National Security Agency. And we know very little about what they do, how they do it. What we do know is that they do it. We need to take this back. We don't have a whole lot more time here before this technology simply outruns us. But I'm not one of those people who thinks that privacy is dead. We just need to get used to it. I think we can put some chains on this growing surveillance monster, but we better do it soon before the monster gets too big.
Well, we have at least one Supreme Court Justice, Scalia, who points out that the word privacy doesn't exist in the Constitution, and therefore there's no constitutional right to privacy. He did that in the context of saying, therefore, Roe v. Wade should be rolled back because it's based on the Fourth Amendment right of a woman's privacy. But I think he probably could broadly interpret it. The fact of the matter is that in 1789, if you said, I want some privacy, that meant I need to use the bathroom. The toilet was called the privy. It was referred to as the private place. And the word privacy had a very different meaning in the 18th century than it does today. I mean, literally, the word had a different meaning. And that's why the word doesn't appear in the Constitution. They wouldn't have thought to guarantee our toilet functions.
Well, but, you know, we do have a Fourth Amendment to the Constitution that,
right,
that you read so clearly.
Yes.
You know, and even Justice Scalia, in a case called Kylo, which was admittedly pre-9/11, a case called Kylo involved the use of particular high technology to peer inside someone's residence. Even he recognized that violated the Fourth Amendment. And then he went on at some length about how the Fourth Amendment had to be adapted to what was then 20th century technology. So we're hopeful that the courts will begin to understand that they have to revisit what the Fourth Amendment means.
Well, I know some of these anti-drug things, you know, they're going around scanning homes with looking for ultraviolet, you know, looking for heat.
That's exactly what Kylo was.
That was that case, okay.
At least with regard to the home, Justice Scalia, of all people, said that with regard to the home, the Fourth Amendment applies.
In the majority or the minority?
He was in the majority. He wrote the majority opinion. He wrote the opinion of the court.
So they can't scan your house now to see if you're growing pot. They can't scan your house to see if you're growing pot anymore, but they can listen to all your communications going in and out, whether it's telephonic or email.
That's the reality now of the law. We have a case pending right now in the courts challenging the most recent amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which we're talking about here.
Yeah.
We'll see how that case goes. We're also hopeful that the next administration will recognize there are limits on its authority and that they will be less resistant to hearing those limits.
We're talking with Barry Steinhardt, the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program. ACLU.org is the website. If you're not a card-carrying member of the ACLU, get over there right now. Barry, we have a minute. What can we do as Americans to push back and regain our civil liberties?
Well, I think the first thing you can do certainly is, it sounds hackneyed, but contact your member of Congress. And say to the Congress that you want the clock rolled back in the sense that you want the Fourth Amendment to mean something. You want the changes made to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You want the Customs and Border Patrol to be reined in. We need to organize in that respect.
It's pretty tough in the face of, you know, like, you know, Lou Dobbs out there going, hysteria, hysteria, look out, the brown people are coming. I mean, you know.
Well, that's right. You know, of course, as you may know, Lou Dobbs set off after us after we did our press conferences earlier in the week. But it's not too late to take back our liberties here.
Good on you. ACLU.org. Get over there. Help them out. Barry, thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Barry Steinhardt, the director of the ACLU's Technology and Liberty Program, ACLU.org. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. We'll be picking up your calls on the way back. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Take control, gotta vote, yeah, you know how it goes. But y'all looking for the cars and clothes, and this other man hope is that y'all don't vote, cuz even he know majority rules, keep majority of the minority fooled. Your vote really does matter, dude, and that attitude, government's loving it, so if you're looking for your retribution, be part of the problem or the solution. Really, all due respect, kid, voting is free, last time I checked it. Look at he crooked and he connected, you don't vote, then he getting reelected. See, I'ma tell him in the style of a rhyme, we can change the world with one vote at a time. Come on, if you don't vote, don't complain, then how you respect the world gonna change it? Everybody got something to say, except when they got
one vote at a time. Changing the world, transforming America by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 866-303-2270. Gary in Jacksonville, Florida, listening on FM 105.7. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. On a little vacation. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier you talked about, and you've been talking about FDR, which is, as you probably recall, it's very dear to my heart. Earlier you talked about the word transformational, vis-a-vis Senator Obama, FDR. Mm-hmm. And I think you were talking also about how he has an opportunity to talk to the American people.
Yeah.
I'd like to, if I may, quickly as I can, just take it one step further, if I may. To me, also, which is just as important, is the word transcend. And what do I mean, transcend? FDR transcended greed. He brought us the New Deal. I know we're in different times, but I still think, I believe, all of me believes that we must transcend greed. And the point I want to add to this, I really think, I don't know if they can do it. The American people have to take some responsibility. They're going to have to transcend this greed. Mm. The president can't do it entirely.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Gary, and point well made. And in fact, Roosevelt talked about that. He talked about this undiluted poison in the American body politic, and about the need to push back against it. Here he is, as I recall.
It has happened time after time in nation after nation during the last 2 years. Fortunately, American men and women are not yet easy dupes. Campaigns of group hatred or class struggle have never made much headway among us and are not making headway now. But new forces are being unleashed. Deliberately planned propagandas to divide and weaken us
in the United States.
In the face of danger, as other nations have been weakened before. These dividing forces, I do not hesitate to call undiluted poison.
There you go. Franklin Roosevelt talking about the right-wingers who are going after him in his day. And I guarantee you, if Obama is elected president, the day after the election, November 5th, will be the day that they begin going after him with claws and hooks and everything. I mean, full out, they're going to be going after him. So, we'll see. James in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, James.
Yeah, how's it going, Tom?
Fine.
Good. I just had a couple of points I'd like to make to you, sir, and then maybe you could just respond to them briefly. First of all, what I'd like to mention is this 250,000 thing that Obama and Biden out there are preaching all of a sudden dropped to 150,000, according to Joe Biden yesterday. The second thing is, does Obama believe in the Constitution, sir?
Obama used to teach the Constitution at the University of Chicago Law School.
Then can you explain to me on that Chicago interview, which was on Fox News yesterday, taken back in 2001 with a radio station, he referred to the Constitution as a charter of negative liberties, sir.
That's exactly what it is. What the Constitution?
Is that right?
Yeah, and the way lawyers refer to negative liberties is these are the things that restrain government. In other words, it's preventing government from asserting itself into your life. The Constitution does not have positive liberties in it. It does not say you have the right to get married. It does not say you have the right to eat food. It does not say you have the right to have a job. It does not say you have the right to walk down the street. What it says is you have the right to be protected from the government inserting its face into your life. That's called a negative liberty in a law school.
So where in the Constitution does it say that health care is a right? And when Keith Olbermann did this interview...
In the preamble to the Constitution, James, in the preamble to the Constitution is where it says that health care is a right. It says that the Constitution is established to provide for the general welfare of the American people. In the Declaration of Independence, it's a founding document, it's not a legal document, but it talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can you have life if you have a life-threatening illness and you can't get help for it?
Sir, when Keith Olbermann talked about Joe the Plumber...
Now, James, how can you have life as defined in the Declaration of Independence if you have a life-threatening illness and you can't get health care?
Why did Keith Olbermann...
James, how can you have life if you have a life-threatening illness and you can't get health care? James, I'm sorry, you're not understanding the question. How can you have life if you have a life-threatening illness and you can't get health care, James?
Why did they edit the Spread the Wealth comment out of Joe the Plumber interview on Olbermann's show?
If you go back and you listen to James has hung up. James, I would encourage you to go back and watch the entire five. It's on YouTube. The entire 5-minute interview with Joe the Plumber and Barack Obama. Obama said we need to cut taxes across the board on the middle class, people making under $250,000 a year, so that we can spread that wealth around and everybody will prosper. That's a common sense statement. It has been taken completely out of context, but it's an absolute common sense statement. The more wealth there is in circulation among people who spend most of their income, which frankly includes you, sir, although tragically you don't understand it, the more wealth there is in the hands of people who spend most of their income, the more it's going to stimulate the economy and the more jobs there will be and the better it is for all of us. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Well, you hope so. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And time for our voting machine alerts. Two whistleblowers are out there talking about what's going on with the voting machines. Stephen Spoonamore was on the program a week or two ago. Chris Hood is now out talking about this. You can read about it over at velvetrevolution.us. And there's a great YouTube of it. We're going to try and get the URL for that up on our homepage here in the next little bit. And Chris Hood, former Diebold contractor and whistleblower. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
Tell us what you did with Diebold and when.
This was during 2000 to 2004 in Maryland and also in Georgia. So my organization, which I was a subcontractor and I had 10 employees in my firm, we worked under Diebold sort of wearing many hats, training of poll workers, training of voters, setting up polling places, programming machines. We pretty much were jacks of all trades for Diebold.
It seems to me that some of those things, setting up the machines, using the machines, I mean, if our elections are supposed to be run by our governments, at what point, in your opinion, was Diebold, was the company that you were working for, asking you to step over that line and handle votes that should have been handled by elections officials, for example?
Yeah, initially it wasn't that obvious. Let me tell you what the main problem was with these machines, is
sure.
that they were so complex and so cumbersome to operate that the typical poll worker couldn't catch on easily. You're talking about poll workers who had worked the polls for years with paper systems, and now they're faced with electronics and complicated instructions, which were frankly, they were written improperly. So there was many, many errors made along the way that caused these machines not to work with poll workers, and therefore Diebold staff had to always stand in, and at the bare minimum, look over the shoulder of the poll worker.
Now, back in 2002, I watched that election in Georgia very carefully. I lived in Georgia for 13 years in Atlanta. And in fact, I wrote an article about it afterwards. And the pre-election polls in the Senate race showed that Max Cleland was a couple of points ahead of Saxby Chambliss. The post-election polls showed that Max Cleland had beat Saxby Chambliss. The voting machines showed that Saxby Chambliss beat Max Cleland by the exact margin that all the polls were showing happened the other way around. The producer of my show at the time, Joe McPherson, who lived in Atlanta, he lived in Cobb County, Georgia, where I used to live, in just north of Atlanta, he went into his polling place and was able, without intending to crash seven voting machines in a row, as I recall. Maybe it was six. He did six or seven. And, I mean, he told that story on the air here on this show simply by pushing the button to do a write-in position on one of the more obscure positions, and it crashed the machine. And the poll worker had to come over, reboot the machine, and apparently blow out all the votes that had been recorded in that machine up to that point. So then he went to the next machine and tried to do it, and every single time, and finally he wiped out all the machines in that polling place. And he was voting around 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he's of the opinion, and the poll worker told him that they thought that all of the votes that had been recorded that morning had been wiped out. Now, is that a reasonable scenario? Was Joe's experience possible?
I've seen poll workers, upon closing the polls at the end of the evening, do the very same thing you're describing. Votes disappeared off the machines, and they were following word-for-word instructions out of the manual, and they erased the machines. Now, being, sort of on the expert personnel side for Diebold, I was able to recover the votes, but I was only in a few places and a few precincts. But can you imagine the votes that got erased? And I'm talking 2004 in Baltimore County, where there were hundreds and hundreds of not votes, but cards that go into these machines, the magnetic media that was actually erased. Whether it was recovered, I have no idea.
Hundreds of cards, and each card would contain presumably thousands or tens of thousands of votes?
many, many votes on each card. So whoever came into the precinct that day and voted on that machine, that card was erased. So multiply those cards by hundreds that I could pretty much identify hundreds of machines that were erased. It was a 2004 presidential election, and I've conducted probably 12 to 16 elections, some very minor elections. But that particular presidential race, 2004, was the messiest election that I had ever conducted.
Has anybody at Diebold ever asked you to patch a machine in a way that is inconsistent with the voting laws?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
This happened a number of times, and most notable in Georgia. Just a few weeks before a major election, Diebold came up with a patch that was to go on a number of machines in some of the counties around Atlanta. That's where I was assigned, and that's where I was working, and that's where the patch was applied. This patch was supposedly to fix the clock on the machine, clock being very important because it keeps the audit trail going. It knows when the polls open, when it closed. And there were some clock problems on a number of machines, and this was supposed to fix it. I applied the patch to over 50 machines. None of those machines had any impact as far as the clock now being accurate after the patch was applied. At that point, I didn't know what the patch was for. It was my understanding that it was going to be deployed all over the state. However, that would have been a monumental task. I do know that DeKalb County, that county was done. I know they had a team of manpower that did patch that county.
Now, DeKalb County, it would be safe to argue, is probably a heavily Democratic-leaning county.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And let me point out one thing, Tom, how easy it is to fix an election. And I want to point this out in reference to Florida. That's where I live now. And I just want to give you an example. It'll be real easy for your audience to understand. Broward, Palm Beach, and Dade County are in the southern part of Florida. They're heavily Democratic. You probably got two-thirds of the registered voters being Democrats in those three counties.
Right.
The rest of the state, a lot of Republicans, central Florida, northern Florida. And I think you can see where I'm going.
Yeah.
If you simply not fix, but throw away or eliminate votes in the three counties in southern Florida, you can flip the entire state and electoral votes will go to another candidate.
Right. And if there was a 3-point or a 4-point spread between Max Cleland and Saxby Chambliss in that 2002 race, that could simply be DeKalb County not being counted.
That's correct. So what you have here is scenario where the public may think it's hard to fix an election, and you don't need to fix a state, you need to fix counties in a state, and the counties or the state that you fix must be key states to the entire national election.
Sure.
So we come down to a state like Florida or Ohio and particular counties within those states.
Well, in the 2002 race, Saxby Chambliss getting that seat in the Senate flipped the Senate from Democrat to Republican.
Yep, very strategic. Absolutely.
So are you of the opinion that you might have applied, was this in the 2002 race by any chance, in DeKalb County?
Yes, it was.
So are
yes.
you of the opinion that in the 2002 race in Georgia, you may have applied a patch that might have fixed the election my particular focus, Chambliss, it might have been, I understand the gubernatorial race also was inconsistent with the exit polling as well.
That's correct. Now, keep in mind the politics of the people who own these companies is very much conservative Republican, more so towards the Rush Limbaugh side, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
And so they have some opinions that are quite questionable. But I think the biggest problem the public faces is that we have to be very, very careful about corporations taking over elections and doing anything that the poll worker or the public should be doing by law. And this is where the line's been crossed over and over again. And, given my way of doing things, I think all these elections need to be videotaped from this point forward. There's just too many things going on.
Or get back to paper. We're talking about Chris Hood, a former Diebold contractor and now whistleblower, about fixing voting machines. Chris, Wally O'Dell, the president of Diebold, was famous for writing in the 2004 election that he was going to deliver Ohio to George W. Bush. Most people figure he just lived in Ohio and he was talking about, his helping out the campaign, not fixing voting machines. Did Wally ever talk with you? Did he ever have any interactions with you?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Did he ever give you a patch to apply to machines or anything like that?
Not Wally himself. Wally was quite a character, sort of eccentric. But I can tell you this, he was a dedicated Republican. And when you're a dedicated Republican, nothing's off limits. For the most part, I think some of the people involved with these elections have this vision of what America should be like and look like, and they'll do anything to carry it out. So nothing is off limits and nothing is wrong because their mission or their crusade is to purify America.
They're of the opinion that the ends justify the means.
Absolutely.
This is the theory of the white liar, the Christian liar, whatever it may be. This is really scary. Chris Hood, we're talking with the former Diebold contractor and whistleblower. Chris, we have about a half a minute left. What should Americans do about this? Particularly, what should we do over the next week if we walk into a polling place with an electronic voting machine?
I think you should be very careful, watch everything that's going on, question everything, put everything that you have in your mind about this being a fair system, put it aside. Go into the polling place as if you're going to be cheated out of your vote, because you probably are.
Right. I said yesterday on a show on Sirius, go ready for war. I mean, it's bring all the ID you can, bring your bills, your utility bills, everything. If somebody's going to challenge your residency, make sure that the machine says what it says. You know, question people. Try to vote on paper. Chris Hood, thanks so much for being with us, Chris.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my.
We're taking our country back, my friends. One Senate seat at a time, one House seat at a time, one Assembly seat at a time, one dog catcher post at a time, right on through with us. We're trying to feature as many as we can here coming up to the election, folks who are doing great work and are in tight races who can use your support. Carol Lutnis is with us right now, a former community organizer, elected member of the L.A. County Democratic Party, the State of California Democratic Party Executive Board, chair of the state chartered Get Out the Vote organization, Democratic Neighbors of the 38th District, and she is running for the California Assembly, their legislature, in District 38. Her website is Lutnis, L-U-T-N-E-S-S, digit4assembly.com. Lutnis, number4assembly.com. Carol Lutnis, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate being on with you.
It's great to have you here with us, and great website you have there. Great smile. I love it. It's really, really well done. Carol, tell us where the 38th District is and why this seat's important.
Well, we are the northern part of Los Angeles. We encompass Santa Clarita and northern parts of San Fernando Valley and out up to La Crescenta. We used to be known as the Orange County of Los Angeles, but that is quickly changing.
Mm-hmm. And who is currently sitting in that District 38 seat, Carol Lutnis?
Cameron Smythe, who never met an oil company, big pharma, HMO, developer, tobacco or alcohol corporation that he didn't love.
Okay, so I think we can have a sense of your agenda, your campaign. We're talking with Carol Lutnis, the website Lutnis, L-U-T-N-E-S-S, digit for assembly, lutnisforassembly.com. She's running for the 38th District in the California Assembly. And, Carol, the importance of taking as many assembly seats as possible in California, why should this concern somebody who's listening, for example, in New York or in Chicago or in Milwaukee or in Miami or in Jacksonville?
All right, this is extremely important because if anyone has ever heard of Grover Norquist, who's famous for saying that he wants to shrink government so small you can drown it in a bathtub, the way they are doing it all over the country If you look on his website, Americans for Tax Reform, they are making Republicans who want support sign, quote, the pledge never to vote for any revenue increase bills. Mm. Well, in California, all but one of the Republicans have signed, and he still votes. He doesn't believe in signing pledges, but he still votes to stonewall our budgetary process. That's happening. If you look on Norquist's site, all over Georgia, North Carolina, every state in the union, representatives of state legislature are stonewalling any kind of way to enhance revenue. That's the way they, quote, starve the beast, is what Reagan says.
Sure.
That's the way they destroy public schools and don't fund infrastructure and services for the old and the elderly and the sick and the disabled and children's health care. This is the way. They don't want to pay taxes. They don't want to pay for services. They have pushed taxes down to the middle and lower classes, and then, of course, the top 1% laughs all the way to the bank.
Right. We're talking with Carol Lutness, her website, Lutness, L-U-T-N-E-S-S, digitforassembly.com. If you have, you know, a credit card and a couple of bucks, this is a good campaign. Carol, what are the things that you're running on? What are you for?
Well, you know, I'm for, number one, returning our schools to be number one. We are 47th in the country now because they have starved us.
You're talking about California schools.
California schools. Mm-hmm. And so they play a political football every year with the schools, making us cut back resources every single year, because the only way we get money for schools and health care and all of that is by cutting programs and then also borrowing. We cannot borrow our way into prosperity. So I want good schools back to where we used to be. I want good, available health care for all, and I want environmental protection that is tough and enforced. But mostly, I want to hold the big fat cats accountable who have brought us to this point of economic disaster. And I'll do that three ways. I will never take money from corporations. I will never vote with the corporations against the people's needs. And I will do everything that I can to really clean up government with clean money.
This is great. Lutness, L-U-T-N-E-S-S, Digit for Assembly, lutnessforassembly.com is Carol Lutness's website. She's running for the 38th District Assembly, California Assembly. Carol, we have just a minute here before we have to wrap up the show. What got you into politics? What motivated you to run for office? That's a pretty scary thing, just getting out there in front of the whole world and running for office.
Well, I started 1959. I'm 21. I was joining the NAACP, the only white woman in the NAACP in Morgantown, West Virginia, or Morgantown, West Virginia. And I didn't know there was Ku Klux Klan all around. I didn't even know what Ku Klux Klan was, but I had been taught to love thy neighbor as thyself and to be stewards of the earth. Now, I've been a political activist ever since, in peace and environment, but what I decided to do this year was because I have an 11-and-a-half-year-old granddaughter, and I cannot leave this world to her and to all of our children without feeling that I have done some tiny, small thing to make it better. And that's why I'm running this year. I've run what's been called the best grassroots campaign since 1992, when Betty Carnett beat the Republican down in Long Beach.
That's
and
great.
So we're working like crazy, and we'll really appreciate any support we can get.
Do you need volunteers from the L.A. area?
Oh, we have hundreds of volunteers. We've people walking all the time, phoning, doing everything they can to help us get elected. And we have a good chance.
That's
year.
Great. Well, we're on the air in Los Angeles on K-Talk. People who want to help out in the 38th District. Lutness, L-U-T-N-E-S-S, digitforassembly.com. Carol, good luck.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being with us. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Tara Ross is going to be here about the Electoral College. Plus, in honor of All Hallows Eve, Dr. Ken Olson, his book, An Exposé of Satan's Schemes. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.